Tom Woods Show, episode 2331.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to have Dan McCarthy back with us. Dan is editor of Modern Age. And Dan, you would think by now I would remember your title at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. But just enough time passes between appearances that my middle-aged brain just can't quite seem to grasp it. So can you remind me?
Yeah, no problem. That is the vice president for the Collegiate Network, which is our network of student publications on about 80 campuses across the country. So I'm a VP with that program.
I want to talk about an article you wrote. I guess it was at American Mind. I'll have it linked on the show notes page. Trump Can Win. So of course, with a title like that, sometimes the author of the article doesn't come up with the title. That's a great title, so because it certainly grabs your attention. You have to read it. What are the arguments being made here in favor of Trump's chances? Well, the way Thomas Aquinas would reckon with a question, he would pose the question, consider some objections, and then he would run into his positive case. And that's sort of the organization I want to use here. I want to throw a few obvious objections at you, and then we'll go into what your positive case is. And a couple of the objections to that claim would be this. Trump's favorability rating is something like 35%, which is catastrophically low. Secondly, it's not clear that he's gained much outside his own base, and he might even have lost a little bit among his base since the last time. And the last two times were pretty close. If a few votes had shifted in a few states one way or the other, the outcome would have been different. So he can't really, he's got to make gains. And I'm not convinced that he's made the gains. And then thirdly, he's just had these charges against him. He's just been, it's true, he was exonerated of the rape charge, but nevertheless, he has a charge of sexual battery against him now. And some people will say, well, this was a kangaroo court, or we obviously know that the thing was rigged. But I don't know, is that going to convince an independent voter? So what do you think of those three things?
If the election were just about Donald Trump in isolation, all of those would be very important questions. But of course, elections are actually comparative choices. You have to compare Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, the incumbent. And there's a lot of political science out there which says that all presidential elections are referenda on the incumbent party. So in this case, Joe Biden himself and his party would be the primary things that voters will be passing judgment on in 2024. Now, admittedly, Donald Trump is such an unusual character that perhaps he would present an exception to that usual case. But if the political science holds true, we would expect Joe Biden and his job performance and his capacity to continue serving as president to be the thing that weighs most heavily on voters' minds. And if you look at those numbers, not only do you see a lot of things that Republicans would point to as reasons to think that Joe Biden is very vulnerable, if you look at how Democrats themselves talk about Joe Biden. If you look at, for example, whether Democrats even want Joe Biden to run for re-election next year, it turns out that a majority of the party basically says that they would prefer to have another nominee other than Joe Biden. The problem they're facing is that they don't, in fact, have any other nominee. Who's it going to be? Pete Buttigieg? Is it going to be Kamala Harris? It's not even possibly credible. The one serious contender that you could possibly have against Biden might be California Governor Gavin Newsom. But for a variety of reasons, Newsom doesn't want to risk his chances on the 2024 election when both Trump and Joe Biden are going to be very difficult factors for anyone to deal with. And so Biden is going to be the Democratic nominee. And Trump is a powerful contrast to Joe Biden. They're both quite old. Trump's in his 70s. Biden is now in his 80s. And yet Trump is much more energetic. One of the arguments I make in my piece is that I think the simple contrast of seeing these two men campaign, seeing Donald Trump go to places in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania in person, organizing large rallies, speaking for long periods of time, versus Joe Biden, who, without having the excuse of COVID, is still going to run basically the kind of basement campaign he ran in 2020. I think Americans are going to say, wait a minute, Trump looks a lot more vigorous. that Biden does. Now, the second thing that has to be considered, of course, is, okay, Dan, you might say, yes, the election is going to be a comparative choice between Joe Biden and the Republican nominee. But why does the Republican nominee have to be Trump? Wouldn't the Republicans be safer if they chose someone other than Trump? And this is really one of the key arguments in my article, which is that the Republicans are deluding themselves to think that their own brand is actually more popular than the Donald Trump brand. And that's not because the Donald Trump brand is perfect or doesn't have all of the baggage that you described a few minutes ago, but rather it's because the Republican brand is actually not terribly popular at all. It's not something that people are enthusiastic about. It's something that even a lot of Republican voters are actually turned off by. So it seems to me that the reason Donald Trump swept to power in 2016, he was able to crush all these champions of the conservative movement and various varieties of Republican Party possible branding in 2016. I mean, you had Ted Cruz, you had Scott Walker from Wisconsin, you had Rand Paul, who I like a great deal. You had a whole variety of representatives of different schools of thought among conservatives and among the Republican Party in 2016. Trump swept over all of them. And it wasn't because it was a divided field. It was because voters, including Republican voters, are actually a lot less engaged on some of those sort of ideologically strict visions than they are simply finding Donald Trump to be an engaging and exciting and a compelling figure. So that's why I think Trump is actually still the strongest Republican nominee, and the Republicans are in a good position for the general election in 2024.
What do you make of the numbers that we see in polls in terms of support for Trump and support for DeSantis? Because what's interesting is that they've diverged over time more and more, with Trump taking an ever larger lead, at the same time that DeSantis has amassed a legislative record that I think most conservatives couldn't have dreamed a governor would implement in one area of society after another. He's just racked up one initiative after another that, I think conservatives would have thought you were in a dreamland to think that you could ever get all those things done. He's gotten them all done, and the more he gets them done, the less support he has.
Yeah, and that unfortunately is simply a truth about politics in a democracy or in a popular republic. Voters are not primarily looking for resumes. What they're looking for is someone to fall in love with. And this is another column that I wrote earlier this week. It's in the New York Post and elsewhere. Voters have a very deep emotional engagement with Donald Trump, love him or hate him. And the approach that Ron DeSantis has taken and that Ron DeSantis' supporters have taken is trying to basically shame you into supporting Ron DeSantis by saying, well, look, he's got the best record. He has a great record in Florida. That's certainly true. And yet you can't just go up to a woman and tell her that she has to date you because, you know, look at what an impressive resume you have. You actually have to have an emotional engagement. And Democratic politics is about that kind of emotional connection between a candidate and the public. I will say that I think DeSantis is facing a great difficulty right now because his whole rationale for running rests on two pillars. One of them being that he is more electable than Donald Trump, that he would poll better against Joe Biden than Trump does. And the other one is that he's more conservative or more effective as a conservative than Donald Trump is. Now, the first of those two pillars, I think, has been crumbling in light of recent polls. A lot of polls in the past several weeks have shown that, in fact, Trump sometimes does better than Ron DeSantis in a direct matchup against Joe Biden. So if that pillar crumbles, the only thing that DeSantis has to make the case that he should be the nominee is this idea that he is a more effective conservative than Donald Trump. But that is an appeal to voters' sense of rationality and their sense of prudence. And voters, I think, are much more romantic about how they look at elections. And you're not going to be able to win their affections away from Donald Trump by claiming to be more effective than he is. The other problem, too, you know, just today I got an email from probably a super PAC or some organization supporting Ron DeSantis. And the whole email was just filled with the same sort of arguments that I would see being made by any number of left-wing media outlets about how terrible Donald Trump is. Ron DeSantis is in a horrible position right now because, on the one hand, his best claim to the nomination is that he is a more competent and younger and perhaps more energetic heir to the whole populist spirit that Donald Trump helped to unleash in 2016. But on the other hand, a lot of the obvious and easy attacks to level against Donald Trump are precisely the attacks that the left has been leveling against him, claiming that he has all these legal problems, claiming that all this is a distraction from America's business. But in terms of image, in terms of the kind of persona that DeSantis is projecting, he can't go on both of those paths. He can't claim to be both the heir to Trump, who's going to be better than Trump, and also claim to be someone who's attacking Donald Trump in the same way that the left is attacking him. There may be logical ways to make that argument, But there's no emotional way that is coherent to make that argument. Because what's going to happen is that Trump voters who would be winnable by DeSantis, who would like to look at DeSantis as someone who will actually carry out a lot of what Trump has talked about, they're going to see these things that DeSantis supporters are saying against Trump. And they're going to say, wait a minute, DeSantis' supporters, they sound like they're exactly like MSNBC liberals. These are people who I just can't trust in terms of where they are coming from, in terms of their feelings and their sympathies and their allegiance. And that sense that they're lined up more with the left than they are with people who are supporting Donald Trump, that's going to be a major break and a major fault line in the coalition that DeSantis is trying to put together.
Let's go back to your point about elections in a society like ours and what they're based on. They're not based on resumes. And it is with a very sad reluctance that I concede that point to you. And the thing is, we can see that in recent American history. Obviously, Barack Obama was able to forge a connection with a lot of Americans. George W. Bush, for all the frustrations we have with him, he was very good at that. He seemed like a simple, regular American you could have a beer with. I think that was the image he was trying to project. And I think Bill Clinton was trying to project that image also. And that whole matter with Sister Souljah in the 1990s was meant to broadcast to America that he's not part of the cultural left in his party. He's just a regular guy like you. So we can see how that kind of approach, how, let's say, the pollsters and the advisors and so on and so forth who are around these candidates help to forge their public persona in a way to make that kind of connection. But how do you advance that thesis in connection with Joe Biden, who does not exude warmth, let's say?
No, I think there are counterexamples, right? So Joe Biden would be one of them. I think George H.W. Bush, when he got a landslide victory in 1988, it wasn't because voters were deeply in love with George H.W. Bush. In both of those cases, I think the appeal of the candidate was a paternal appeal or a grandfatherly appeal. In the case of George H.W. Bush in 88, what Americans wanted and thought they were getting was going to be someone to carry on the exciting program that Ronald Reagan had introduced them to in the two elections previously. So they were looking at George H.W. Bush as a kind of continuation figure, someone who would provide expertise and a prudent approach to the Reagan agenda. And of course, what they got was actually something very disappointing. They got an imperial foreign policy in Gulf War I. They got tax increases, a betrayal of Reagan's program. And so when George H.W. Bush came up against Bill Clinton, who was a very charismatic candidate, as you pointed out, in 1992, Bill Clinton walked right to the White House. And it was clear that George H.W. Bush was in grave danger throughout the 92 campaign. Joe Biden, he too presented himself as being a reassuring kind of grandfatherly figure after all the turmoil, not only of the Trump years in general, but of 2020 in particular, which was the year of BLM riots, was the year of COVID. Joe Biden was meant to be this reassuring figure. And people actually did think of him as being regular Joe. Think about the way The Onion, for example, and this can be a good insight into politics by looking at popular culture. The Onion, when Joe Biden was vice president, did this great series on Joe Biden where they presented Joe Biden as this New Jersey kind of guy who had his car up on blocks and stuff and was always just a regular kind of guy who was interested in beer and rock and roll and whatnot. A lot of people really believe that that was what Joe Biden was. And Joe Biden sometimes tries to project that image. Now, obviously, that was a hard image for him to project even in 2020. And in 2024, I think it's much, much harder still. But that was a real thing. And a lot of voters, they are able to convince themselves that they see in a candidate what they want to see. And what they wanted to see in Joe Biden was both this idea of a reassuring figure, but also the idea of an everyman who makes a lot of the fact that he has personal connections to the state of Pennsylvania. Joe Biden reminds them of this idea of the Irish-American, Catholic, working-class Democrat. All of that, of course, is totally fraudulent where Biden is concerned. But that's the image that Biden has tried to cultivate over many decades. And so even though he was personally quite decrepit already in 2020, a lot of Americans still had that image of him. And it was an image that they found quite attractive. Whereas Donald Trump in 2020, he ran one of the worst campaigns that I've ever seen. And first of all, the people he appointed to run his campaign were totally incompetent. Second, Trump himself seemed to be rather detached from the election, didn't really seem to have the kind of passion that he had in 2016. And he seemed to either be taking it for granted or to really not want to win re-election. And so when Donald Trump became much more passionate about the election after Election Day than he was before it, that was kind of a surprise to me because, again, I thought Trump really fumbled things as much as he possibly could in 2020. Now, he seems to be much more focused and driven in 2024. So I think a rematch is going to work out, has the potential to work out well for Trump. The other thing, too, is that in 2020, we knew what we were getting with Donald Trump. We had the Trump-Pence ticket. Everyone knew what that stood for. People wanted to project onto this new Biden ticket and Kamala Harris, who was obviously not really adding a lot of momentum to that ticket. But people wanted to believe that they were going to get competence and really a change in America that was going to smooth things over and bring us back to very placid times. And of course, that hasn't happened. Instead, the Biden record has actually been a disaster, and people are much more unhappy now than they were during the Trump years. Now, in 2024, Trump is able to present something a little bit different, a little bit new relative to what he was presenting in 2020, because now Trump has will be choosing a new vice president. And the question is, can he choose a vice president who will bring something to the ticket that Mike Pence wasn't bringing? And Pence was put on the ticket originally in 2016 in order to reassure ordinary sort of evangelical conservative Republican voters that the ticket was still a ticket they should support, even if they had problems with Donald Trump's personal life. In 2024, that's not really an issue. We know that evangelical voters are going to support Trump by pretty wide margins. And the question is, can Trump put someone on the ticket who's going to add maybe a state to his coalition, or maybe reassure some Republicans who they might be very squishy moderate types and they really need someone who's going to reassure them that a second term would be good for American business? Republicans were very interested in corporate matters and whatnot. Or if he adds a Black or Hispanic vice president, does that help to magnify the gains that we already saw Trump making in 2016 and in 2020 with minority voters? There's a lot of possibilities here, and those possibilities are open in 2024, whereas they weren't in 2020.
All right, well, I have a couple things. Let's go back to what you said about Biden. At the time, I pointed out a small detail, but political campaigns are carefully choreographed and very little is done by accident. And his campaign bus had on the side of it the words, "No malarkey." Now, nobody under 40 has ever even heard the word malarkey. So I took that as, again, they're not just randomly putting words on the side of that bus. I took that as reassurance to older Americans that I come from your generation. You know, I'm just like you. And I use these folksy old sayings. So I think that is, as you say, I think that's what they were going for. I mean, obviously, it had some success, I guess. But yeah, he is hard to fit into this mold of super charismatic candidates. What did you make of Trump's attacks on DeSantis, which I guess have subsided, that went on for quite some time? DeSantis didn't directly respond to them, but they were things like DeSantis locked down too much, which is kind of reminding me of Randy Weingarten saying she wanted open schools. I mean, of all things to say about DeSantis.
Yeah, I don't think that the attacks themselves had much substance or really landed. But the mere fact that a leader that so many Republicans had given their hearts to was saying DeSantis is a bad guy, I think that, unfortunately, does have an effect. If somebody who's really a close friend of yours says, hey, you know this other person, you may not have a personal relationship with this other person, but I am that person's enemy. You'll often see that friendships and enmities, that they are like a daisy chain. And if you're really committed to a friend, then your friend's enemy is also your enemy. And so when Donald Trump, who has this great emotional sway with huge swaths of Republican voters, and recent polls suggest maybe even a majority of Republican voters, when Trump just says anything negative about anyone, a lot of those voters are automatically going to say, well, you know what, because Trump is saying it, there must be something to it. And even if it seems like what Trump is saying in terms of actual facts about COVID don't add up, nevertheless, Trump must be onto something, because he wouldn't be someone that we would trust and we would give our affection to, who would then make bad choices about who he in turn considers either to be on his side or not on his side. Now, of course, if you look at Donald Trump's appointments during his term from 2017 to 2021, lots of bad appointments. Donald Trump has chosen lots of bad friends over the years. He's also made enemies of some good people over the years. I think, for example, the way he trashed Jeff Sessions was totally a wrong move by Donald Trump. And that's not to say Sessions was perfect, but Sessions really was someone who believed in the Trump agenda. And Trump took the only Republican senator who had endorsed him in the early part of 2016 and basically not just fired the guy, which is one thing, but tried to make the guy radioactive and poisonous to the conservative base and the Republican base. And he succeeded, of course. When Sessions tried to get back into the U.S. Senate, Trump was against him. And even though Sessions had a great record, Sessions wound up losing his primary to try to get back into the Senate. Nevertheless, that Sessions lesson, I think, is a lesson that DeSantis would be well advised to look at and learn from. Because again, Sessions had the record on issues like immigration. He was by far the best Republican before Donald Trump to be advancing a Trump-like agenda. Yet that counted for absolutely nothing when the affections of Republican voters were put to the test, even in the state of Alabama, where, of course, Sessions had these deep roots and had relationships going back decades. Donald Trump totally overrode all of them. There's a danger that that kind of thing will happen to Ron DeSantis, and that would be a tragedy for DeSantis's future.
Well, let me ask you this. If you were Ron DeSantis and you're looking at these numbers, what are you going to do? Some people say, well, he should, quote, wait his turn till 2028. But I think maybe you might have been the one who said, you have to run when you're hot. And he's hot now. And in 2028, 4 years is a long time. I mean, 5 years from now, he could be old news. It's either now or never. But yet now the circumstances look not very auspicious. So what would you do?
You're right that I've taken on this issue, although I actually had the opposite conclusion. All of my friends who think that Ron DeSantis has to run right now in 2024, they make this argument that this is the moment and you just don't know what's going to happen in 2028. Therefore, while your hand is hot, you've got to put it in and you've got to try to get the prize in 2024. I looked back to Niccolo Machiavelli, and in The Prince, he talks a lot about the contrast between fortuna on the one hand and virtue or virtu on the other hand. Virtu are the intrinsic qualities that you yourself possess as a human being, especially as a man. It means your own skill and competence and capability. Fortuna is everything that you can't control. That includes nature, it includes luck, it includes God, it includes absolutely anything that's outside of your control. And Machiavelli, on the surface, seems to be saying, well, you've got to take fortune into consideration and you have to sort of obey fortune. But then he also says in a number of other places, then basically you can't let yourself be run by fortune, because if you do that, you're basically showing that you don't have confidence in your own virtue, your own strength, and that you're in fact a plaything of forces that you can't control, that you're unmanly, and that you're basically a loser. So Machiavelli's ultimate advice, despite the sort of mixed impressions he might give you, is that you need to trust your own virtue and not trust in fortune. The fact that all of the arguments for DeSantis running right now are based not on DeSantis's virtue, but rather on DeSantis's moment, on this fortune that he can't control, that tells me that, in fact, he should not be running in 2024. He should be looking to 2028. And I make a prudential argument there because, look, in 2024, you know for a fact you're going to have a hard time getting the Republican nomination away from Donald Trump. It's going to be difficult. And even if you succeed, you're probably going to wind up with a split party, a very divided party, a lot of bruised feelings. Donald Trump is not going to be a happy loser. You're going to wind up with something that's going to be a mess, even if you can succeed in winning the nomination. Then you have to take on an incumbent president in the general election. And even though Biden has plenty of baggage, the fact is incumbents usually win re-election. So that also is going to be a very tough battle. And you're also in this very difficult position of, again, do you make yourself out to be the heir to Donald Trump, which would be the logical thing to do since Donald Trump's brand really transformed the party after 2016? Or do you make yourself out to be a break with Donald Trump, since a lot of conservative intellectuals think that the Donald Trump brand is so toxic and can't win in November? Either of those choices you make, you're probably going to wind up taking a big risk. Because if you want to define yourself as not Trump or beyond Trump, you're going to lose a lot of people who are enthusiastic about the Trump agenda. And if you define yourself as being totally tied to the Trump agenda, people are going to ask, well, wait a minute, if that's what we want, then why don't we just have Trump as our nominee instead of you? So DeSantis is facing all of these complications and difficulties in 2024. He's only 44 years old. He's not nearing expiration. He's governor of Florida for the next 3 years. His term is going to expire in January of 2027, I believe, which is really the optimal time to start mounting a 28 campaign. By that point, he'll have 8 years of accomplishments as governor of Florida. Why not wait? Why not be a little patient? And in 4 years' time, 5 years' time, you're going to be more experienced. You're going to have more wins to your name, assuming you trust your own virtue and think you're going to succeed in Florida. And you're not going to have these legacy features of politics from the 2016 and 2020 and 2020 and now, right? You're not going to have Trump and Biden. It's almost like going up against two incumbents, right? I mean, Trump is almost an incumbent in terms of the Republican nomination, and Biden actually is an incumbent in terms of the White House. Why throw all of your political capital into this battle rather than using your political capital in 2028, when it's clear that you won't have Trump or Biden, barring some sort of strange event, Trump and Biden won't be factors. And again, you will be all the stronger if you've trusted in your own skill, strength, and virtue as the governor of Florida. So my advice to DeSantis really would be to look to 28, but he's obviously not doing that. He's obviously going to try to run in 2024. My advice to him in 2024 would be run on your strengths and basically show yourself to be an ultra-competent governor, as you've already done, a very conservative governor. You've got to branch out. You've got to learn to talk to Rust Belt Americans, which I think is a problem for DeSantis right now. He's very much a Sun Belt opportunity kind of governor, which is great. But we also need to be able to have a candidate who's viable in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, et cetera. Trump seems to do better at that than DeSantis does. So DeSantis has to start talking about the interests of Rust Belt working class Americans. And that may be a bit of a shift for him. He might have to talk about trade and other things. But that's what I would do. I would not, if I were DeSantis, try to get into a spitting contest with Donald Trump. Instead, I would say, look, I really am going to stick to my guns. I'm going to be a very effective leader for the issues that you care about. Even understanding that voters are not primarily looking for a resume, nevertheless, your resume is your strongest thing. So run on it. And then try to connect that resume with voters' emotions and say, look, I understand that people across this country, especially in the Rust Belt, they're dying deaths of despair. They're committing suicide. They're shooting up heroin. They're taking other opioids. Jobs are being lost. I have a program, an agenda that's going to bring things back. Don't just talk about the agenda, but talk about the emotional connection that that agenda should have to voters. I think actually DeSantis should look back at how Pat Buchanan, for example, connected with voters in New Hampshire and elsewhere in 1992 and 1996. And that will show the way in which DeSantis could almost be the empathy candidate trying to connect with these voters and let Donald Trump be the guy who's always throwing lightning bolts and causing explosions and fire and whatnot. But the other problem too here is that I think Donald Trump does have a better sense of humor than Ron DeSantis does. And that, again, if you're a man and you're trying to date a woman, women like a sense of humor. It's a very important thing for them. And voters, I argue in a piece that I wrote earlier this week, voters are all women in that sense. They all want someone with a sense of humor, with a sense of emotional engagement. So if I were DeSantis, I would also maybe hang out with Dave Chappelle, try to learn how to tell good, funny stories and jokes.
What is the best website for people who like Dan McCarthy to go to now? Because, of course, I could send them to modernagejournal.com, but maybe you want me to send them to ISI. What do you recommend?
Yeah, so first of all, please do visit ISI.org. As I said, I'm a vice president at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. We actually have an important event taking place in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, May 17th at Catholic University of America. It's going to be in the early evening, around 5 p.m. We have an event with Senator J.D. Vance, with the Notre Dame political philosopher Patrick Deneen, talking about his new book, Regime Change, and with Kevin Roberts of the Heritage Foundation and Christine Enbo of the Washington Post. I will be moderating this panel. Again, it's on Wednesday, May 17th. And if people go to ISI.org, they'll find details of this event. And I really think it'll be great. It's going to, again, be about the idea of regime change right here in America and the idea that progressive liberalism is a total disaster. And then the question is what comes after it. So I really recommend that. In terms of following my other work, I'm a syndicated columnist with Creator Syndicate. You can find my column every week, every Monday or Tuesday in the New York Post, nypost.com. You can also find it at Chronicles Magazine. So just Google Chronicles or Google Daniel McCarthy, New York Post, and you'll find that stuff. You can certainly find me on Twitter at Tory Anarchist.
Well, I read every single Dan McCarthy column, just so you know. I read every single one of them, and I'm so glad that you have joined up with Creator Syndicate and that you got that invitation. Because, of course, I would love to see your voice in front of more and more people and to be a syndicated columnist. Oh, my gosh. I remember growing up as a kid, I remember thinking that was what I most wanted to do. It was because I used to read all these syndicated columnists. Did you ever read a publication called The Conservative Chronicle?
Yeah, I did not get to see too many issues of it, but I know what it was. It was a compilation of syndicated columnists from everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a compilation. So you would have Thomas Sowell in there and Walter Williams and a whole bunch of other people. And I loved all these columns. And I remember thinking, boy, that would be the greatest thing in the world. And now I think about it and I think, oh, the pressure to have something original to say all the time. I think I'm happy just reading Dan McCarthy instead. So Dan, congratulations on all the good things happening in McCarthy world. And thanks for your time.
Thanks, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.